So important data here for entrepreneurs to consider. The most important things here are that if you get product market fit early, you're going to be in great shape. Because if you get product market fit early, then you need to raise less capital and you own more of the cap table and you spend less time fundraising. People who don't have product market fit have to convince people, create arguments, as opposed to just showing their data and saying, talk to my top three customers. If your top three customers are over the moon, it's all going to work out.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Squarespace. Turn your idea into a new website. Go to squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use offer code TWIST to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Fidelity Private Shares. If you want the all-in-one equity management platform, Fidelity Private Shares has you covered. Visit fidelityprivateshares.com. Mention this podcast for 20% off your first year subscription. And Inbound. Connect with visionary leaders like Dario Amodei and Amy Poehler at Inbound 2025, September 3rd through 5th in San Francisco, the epicenter of tech innovation, and transform your business strategy for the AI era. Use code TWIST10 for 10% off your general admission ticket at inbound.com/register. Valid through July 31st.
All right, everybody, welcome back to This Week in Startups. I'm your host, Jason Calacanis. With me, my co-host, Alex Wilhelm. How are you, Alex? Happy Monday.
I'm tremendous. I can't tell you how glad I am to be back at work. This was a busy weekend, and nothing feels better than focus and time.
Ah, very nice, very nice. I guess it's been a slow news week, so we'll see if we have anything on the docket that we can get to. I'm sure people have a lot of questions for me.
Yeah, but first though, Jason, you're in LA, and so we're coming here an hour later, but you wanted to talk a little bit about what you've been up to with the family, you said.
Oh, well, no, I was just telling you, I went directly from Singapore to Los Angeles to do a quick Disney trip with the girls. That was quite nice. I got to do, I guess it's going to become a yearly tradition now to go there. And we had, like, you know, the in-laws and, you know, friends from LA when we lived here. So we had 10 people.
Oh,
but
man,
we did this VIP tour thing again. And oh my Lord. So took a little of that speaking gig money and put it towards the VIP tour. My speaking fees in Singapore go directly to my Disney adventure. But yeah, it was quite nice to take a day off. And then, of course, my phone is blowing up because everybody's asking me, hey, where's the episode of the other podcast? And I was like, yeah, refer to my tweet. I'm taking a beat. So we'll get to the news that we have in front of us here.
There's
so much going on. It's almost hard to process it. I see we have a lot going on in the venture space.
Yep.
And then a lot of people talking about early stage startups and their valuations, which people listening to This Week in Startups are going to obviously really care about. I know we're going to do an office hours at the end here.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a great trip to Singapore. I don't know if we like recap the trip at all.
We talked about the tokenization of venture funds last Friday, but we had a short time frame because of housekeeping, if I recall correctly.
Oh yeah, housekeeping kept knocking on my door at the hotel I was at when I first landed here. Well, my jet lag's good now. I'm sleeping. I've been trying out this Whoop. The founder of Whoop sent me the Whoop 5.
Ooh.
Very interesting device, by the way. Now, I got comped out on it, so it's not like I paid for this. So take the review for what it's worth, full disclosure, my old journalistic ethics. But it's actually kind of like an addicting device because it gives you like your stress, your energy, like your preparedness. It's much better than the Apple Watch's native software, obviously.
Ah.
But I kind of like my 8 sleep data a little bit better, but overall a bit addicting. And I'm starting to see a double-fisted trend. When I was in Singapore, you know, people there are pretty affluent, right? It's kind of like a Hong Kong, New York, London scene. So people are paying a decent amount for rent. And if you're there, you're probably making a pretty penny. And there's zero capital gains tax in Singapore, by the way. So if you were running a venture firm,
you might want to
real estate
there.
I mean, whoa. They were talking about that. I was like, wait, I'm sorry, one more time?
Okay, 0%? Is that what you said?
0% capital gains is what I was told. I looked it up. It seems to be the case. I think that's why I like the one of the Facebook co-founders, Eduardo.
Yeah, Saverin.
Saverin lives there supposedly. Maybe he wanted to take a different route. He's been there for a long time, maybe 15 years. I don't know when the Facebook IPO was. But he had to pay an exit tax. So when you leave the United States, they make you settle up, as it were. So if you had $10 million in Facebook shares and you went to Singapore, as I met somebody who was there who had just given up their citizenship. And so, you know, the other thing when I was in Singapore that was super interesting, Alex, is I was talking to a lot of parents. Now, these are people who are in typically mixed race or multi-ethnicity, multiple, what would be the way to say it? I mean, a lot of people in Singapore, multiple nationalities, perfect. But also mixed race, whatever. So multiple nationality couples. So, you know, one person's from America, but lived in Dubai, was educated in London, and now lives in Singapore. Another person's from New Zealand, but grew up in Japan and China, and now lives in Singapore. Like, these are the 1% of the 1% of elites who travel the world doing commerce, their children. Unlimited money, resources, and ability to move around the planet and live where they want to.
Mm.
And, you know, multiple passport holder type people, right?
Yep.
Their kids, they were saying, don't want to come to America for school. They're concerned. One of them was concerned their kids were in school, and the talk in their class was, hey, maybe we don't leave the country, America, to go on spring break or go see our parents over Christmas, because what if we can't get back in?
Yep.
Maybe the parents have to come see them, you know, in Boston at Harvard or something, because they're afraid they're not going to get back in. So it's like a real palatable frustration, fear, and even maybe on the margins, a little bit of anger or disappointment. And then on the trade basis, not understanding what's going to happen with trade for their businesses, and that their businesses are looking at other options for trade partners. So I was, you know, sort of really taking pause on that, because as somebody who travels the world on a regular basis, when I was in Dubai, Doha, Riyadh, Japan over the, you know, previous 5 years, it was always, oh, you're American. Oh, that's amazing. My daughter's going to school, you know, in Berkeley, or, oh, my son is going to go, is there on vacation and he wants to go be a ski instructor in Tahoe. Like, these are the conversations that were happening just, you know, the last 5 years, not the last 5 months. So there's something definitely happening in that regard. But the reason this, you know, sort of applies to startups, I think, is a lot of these startups are going to not come to the US. They're deciding to go to Dubai or Riyadh or Singapore or Australia or stay in Europe or whatever, but generally going to really super friendly places to business.
Mm-hmm.
That and still attacking the U.S. market, right? Still going after U.S. customers, but just from a different HQ,
yeah.
Which means different investors, which means different employee bases not being based in the U.S. I just look at that and I was like, I need to bring Founder University or startup program to Singapore or Japan and the Middle East, and maybe start capturing some of this energy if we're going to balkanize the startup communities and people are not going to come to the U.S., the best and brightest talent. Maybe it's time to create funds with foreign LPs, with foreign structures, foreign tax brackets, et cetera, and just domicile that. And then I just started thinking about that, and I was like, wait a second. You know, I'm not going to pop myself up here, but I'm a modest player in the startup ecosystem. And I'm thinking, you know, I fund 100 companies a year, 50 of them wind up, 60 of them wind up, well, 60 of them wind up going on to get more funding. So, you know, it's, you know, some of these companies, two of the companies I think are in the S&P 500. I think Robinhood's about to be put in the S&P 500. So two of my first 100.
Bad news. It didn't get put in and its stock went down and everyone's very sad.
Okay. So it was on the bubble. But anyway,
right there. Yeah.
Right there. Right. So, I mean, I'll probably have two of my companies in my first 100 bets be in the S&P 500, Robinhood and Uber. That's kind of mind-blowing. Maybe I'll do that again. You know, maybe in the next 100, I'll hit another two. Who knows? Anything's possible.
Well, Jason, we all know you do need more money. I think about you every day and I think to myself, Jason Calacanis, he's just running out.
Yeah. So anyway, what I just came to this conclusion of is there's a large number of deep-pocketed individuals outside the world and future deep-pocketed individuals who are just not interested in America anymore. And that made me sad. All right, founders, let's talk about your website. I know, disgraziad, you're ashamed of your website. I know. Well, it's time to clean it up. Give your brand a quick refresh with Squarespace. That's the all-in-one platform that makes building a stunning, professional, gorgeous website ridiculously easy. Doesn't matter if you're selling products, doesn't matter if you're offering services, or, you know, if you're just showcasing your portfolio. Squarespace gives you everything you need to grow. They've got this great new AI product. It's called Blueprint. You got to try it. You just answer a few questions and you get a fully customized website in minutes. Personalized layouts, on-brand visuals, and voila, you're done. I've been using this product for over a decade. Check out squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/twist to get 10% off your first website or domain purchase. Once again, squarespace.com/twist. And then I thought, wait a second, I'm talking about spending whatever energy I have left as, you know, in the third act of my career and likely final, you know, see what happens with life extension. But, you know, if I'm in my third act here and it's going to be the last act of me, you know, in terms of professionally, I'm actually thinking like, maybe I spend half my time on things outside the US. This should be concerning to folks. And it was certainly concerning to me. So I'm just putting that out there. I'm going to write a blog post about it on my Substack and just, but I think the opportunity means there's going to be a lot of opportunity for founders who, if you're not getting funded in the US, I think you can get funded quickly in Dubai, Riyadh, Doha, Singapore, you know, Australia. Like maybe there's other startup markets if you could equally get funded as you might in San Francisco.
I want to stay on this theme though, because this actually dovetails well with both the YC conversation we're going to have, given its centrality in the San Francisco, therefore US market, Jason. But just before we get into that, I want to point out that the discussion about people staying in their home markets and not coming to the United States to do business and so forth is not idle. It's happening now to some degree. So Mistral is a French foundational AI model company. We've talked about them on the show a couple of times, part of the Twist 500. And they've made a number of pretty cool agents and apps and so forth. Anyways, the reason why I have them on the docket today is that according to, I think it's the FT, Mistral has, quote, secured new contracts worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's going to help it raise probably about another $1 billion this year. What are these deals? Well, they're multi-year agreements with what I can tell is mostly European companies. So here we are seeing kind of the leading sovereign EU AI player absorb quite a lot of local business because, back to your point, I don't think the United States and US companies and US technologies have the same trustability, you might say, as they did 6-12 months ago. Now, in this case, it's helping this company grow that we care about, but those contracts could have gone to probably an American company 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, they're not a major player. There's some protectionism, I guess, in Europe, and the people want to use the local homegrown product. It doesn't make sense to me that, you know, these customers would use what is probably an inferior product, not the most competitive product. So I wonder what's going on there, right? Like, or maybe people are just testing it, but they only have $100 million worth of revenue, Mistral. Is that correct here?
They're supposed to get to about $100 million this year. Yeah.
Oh, it's supposed to get to 100. So looking at that, combining it with the breaking news about OpenAI hitting 100 times that, I think that kind of tells the story maybe, which is the people who are using Mistral and they secured all these new contracts worth hundreds of millions of dollars. It's probably people sampling it and they could cancel it. So, you know, when you see hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts, always as journalists or as an insider, former journalist, you would look at it and say, you know what? That might be a 5-year deal. That goes for, you know, 5 to 10 to 20 to 40 to 80, or maybe they made the estimates of what those contracts are worth. So you have to take it with a, I don't want to say a grain of salt, but in context to this isn't going to the bottom line this year, perhaps. If they said they have hundreds of millions, it's 100 million going to come in here, that might make sense. So
the company, though, really agrees with you. They said that, quote, sovereignty is not our core business. But the company did say that in the last 100 days, it tripled, and in particular in Europe and outside of the US. So they're trying to be not the EU's protectionist, like, you know, welfare beneficiary. They're trying to be a global competitor with open source models and agents. I just think that they're just seeing a lot of local demand because people have a little bit more faith and trust in them than perhaps a Microsoft or something similar. So I think they're playing it straight. But I do agree, though, Jason, we need to be cautious about these long-term bookings because, I don't know, if a company came to you and said, we have a five-year contract, how many years of that are you going to give them credit for today? Two? Probably?
I guess you'd have to look at the details in the contract and what the cancellation is. Most of these things have a 3 to 6 month out. So with 3 months notice or 6 months notice, you can cancel the contract. None of them would ever be like locked in. I wonder if even an NVIDIA contract for the most sought after product in the world right now, like H100s, would those even be guaranteed or not? Like, maybe you have, you know, till 3 months out to cancel it. Like I said, when you order a car, you know, there's a point at which you can't return it, or you order a hotel room, there's a point at which you can't return it. In business, I would say it's usually a yearly contract. You get a discount for doing the year. You can cancel with 3 months notice or 6 months notice within that year. So if you got to month six and you decided to cancel, you earliest you could get out is month 9 or month 12, in which case you're just going to use it for the rest of the year. But it is interesting that they're saying people are looking to them because they don't want a US product. That's kind of what they're saying, is they're getting an uptick in European folks who want it.
Yeah, a nice tailwind, if you will, but they still want to compete and sell everywhere.
I mean, if they're going after the foundational market space, it does seem like that is becoming quickly commoditized, indistinguishable. You know, they're kind of all leapfrogging us. When you look at the Poly market for who's going to have the best model, which we could pull up right now, I notice it keeps changing. So, you know, OpenAI, and I think OpenAI and Google Gemini keep going back and forth as the most expected best model on the benchmarks. And
so this is the which company has the best AI model at the end of 2025, Jason. I picked the furthest time frame that I could see. This market has about $900,000 in volume, so not the most, but not zero. And wow, Google has a 51% chance right now. OpenAI is in second place, XAI 16%, Anthropic 8%, and Mistral does not even make the betting, but Alibaba, Meta, and DeepSeek all get a couple of points each. So there you go.
So this is like very interesting to look at, because the people who would participate in that kind of a market are people with an edge. It's one of the things I love about Polymarket. Shout out to my friends at Polymarket. They are capturing that 900,000 are people who are deep insiders on betting. People who really are either working on the models, work with the models, you know, some developer in Ukraine who's looking at it going, you know what? Some developer in Sydney who's looking at it going, you know what? I think based on my firsthand knowledge, it's going to be either Gemini or OpenAI. I use this stuff every day and I know their release schedule. I mean, this is by the end of 25. Somebody might even know the release schedules, right? And so that's why this is so valuable to look at. It's either going to be one of those two companies, 85%, I think, if you put the first two together, something like that. Was it 84? 74. 85? Oh, 74 put together. So, you know, and then XAI right behind them in third place. So you put those three together, now you're looking at 90. So it's like, it's a three-horse race right now.
Yeah.
Mistral's not in it currently. Even Meta's not in it. That's fascinating too, with all open source.
You know what? Mistral does a lot of open source work too. And so we're actually seeing, Jason, Mistral and Meta, the two open source kind of what I would call leading lights, apart from anything coming out of China, really not perform as well as we might have expected. Because if you think about what we were saying 6 months ago, we were saying, you know, maybe this open source stuff is going to be the winners. And doesn't seem to be the case yet, at least. I'm a little surprised.
It would make sense that the closed products with lots of backing, those three have the most backing, and the most hardware would do the best. The open source ones don't have as much iron. It's the exception of Meta, but even Meta, I think, is behind on iron. So, and they're open source, so they go slow to go fast. And slow is smooth, smooth is fast. I think that's it. The Marines or something, when they're cleaning their guns, or whacking Osama bin Laden. So, interesting. I'm interested to see when people start betting on an open source model to win the day.
This advertisement is paid by Fidelity Private Shares. All right, founders.
We all know cap tables, due diligence, and of course, managing investors is a huge headache, but there's a very simple solution for you. Today, we're talking with Kristen Kraft, an old friend of mine, and she works at Fidelity Private Shares, a new group over at Fidelity. You've heard of Fidelity before, and they have a mission to help startups simplify equity management. They're going to save you money. They're going to give you better service. Welcome to the program, Kristen.
Thank you so much, Jason. It's great to see you again.
Yeah, great to see you as well. Maybe just from a product perspective, what are you trying to accomplish with the product?
So, Jason, we are super excited about our cap table management and data room platform. We want to make it super simple for founders and startup operators to manage all sort of ownership and equity in the company and essentially prepare to raise. We want to make sure that everybody goes into these fundraising conversations well-prepared, they're ready to share their cap table, and that they're ready to go through due diligence as they're trying to close their round. So from a product perspective, that is where we're laser focused. And that product is really well built, really strong attention to detail in the way that Fidelity is known and beloved for.
So if you want an all-in-one equity management platform, Fidelity Private Shares, they've got you covered. Visit fidelityprivateshares.com. That's one word, no spaces, no dashes, fidelityprivateshares.com. And hey, mention This Week in Startups, they'll give you 20% off your first year subscription. Once again, fidelityprivateshares.com, and tell them that you heard about it here on This Week in Startups.
Yeah, we'll see. In the meantime, the corollary to the story, everybody, is that OpenAI, about 45 minutes ago, announced via CNBC that they have reached the $10 billion ARR threshold. Jason, I'm not going to lie. I did not think that OpenAI, best known for, of course, for ChatGPT and the O series of reasoning models, was going to be this big, this fast. I knew it was growing quickly, but I didn't expect this. Data point for everybody, $3.7 billion in revenue last year. Jason, of course, that would put them at a higher ARR number at the end of 2024. But did you expect to see $10 billion this soon?
No. and I'm wondering how much of it is enterprise versus consumers. That's like kind of the key here is how much of it is people just, you know, startups who are raising a bunch of money, big companies throwing jobs at it, or the second pillar of their stool, which is consumer subscriptions. Mm-hmm. We did have that information previously from last year. So do you have it handy by chance? Is it 50-50? Is it 70-30?
I don't have that exact split, but I do have the most recent business announcement from them is that they went from 2 million paying business subscribers in February to 3 million, I think it was last week.
3 million, and they business people pay $40 a month or something? It's 120 million a month?
At a minimum. So that would be 1.4?
1.4
billion?
Yeah.
I will say, though, CNBC did add that the $10 billion ARR figure, according to OpenAI, includes consumer ChatGPT business products and its API, but does not include licensing revenue from Microsoft and large one-time deals, which makes sense as it's an ARR number. But I do like that they gave that clarification so we can mostly trust that this is a reasonable annual recurring revenue figure versus just kind of a run rate statistic. I like that.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. I do think we're going to see the consumer products are going to be free. I think that the idea that consumers are going to pay for this, that could be a short-term thing. People used to pay for the Netscape browser.
Yep.
They don't pay for their browser anymore. So I don't think subscription revenue will be a thing. I think subscription revenue is a thing right now because these are expensive products.
Mm-hmm.
To run, to operate. But as they get cheaper to operate, there's no reason Apple, Google, or Facebook would ever charge for them. They'll just include them in their free product. So then what does the pro get you? Like, it might be the pro is kind of like getting extra storage from iCloud. The pro could be, I don't know, having your badge on Twitter or X. I'm not sure what the pro version of all this is, but I think you're going to get 99 of 100 queries that'll be capable of being done by a free service that's advertising based, which could be the third leg of the stool. I wouldn't be surprised if in the next year or two, Sam Altman says, we now have an advertising product. You put in your URL, you put in what your product's about, and we present it to users and you pay us a dollar cost per click. and it's just integrated into the text. If you use the free product, you have to see an ad before you use it. You have to watch a video before you use it. Or, you know, on the sidebar, there's links, or in between your answer, there's links. You have to click a link to see an interstitial, and then you get your result. Yeah, actually, that would work. I just figured out the new model. While you're waiting for your result, you have to wait 15 seconds or 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. You have to watch a video commercial while your result's doing, and just like the 5 second skip. That would be the perfect model for a free version of ChatGPT.
Just enough friction to make you pay if you want, or just enough friction to monetize with it via an advertisement, but not so much that it ruins the experience. I dig it. And backing up your thought there, Jason, don't forget they hired Fiji, the former CEO of Instacart. She is previously not only of Instacart, but also of Meta, which makes its money off advertising. And under her tenure, Instacart made a lot of money off advertising inside of its application. So quite a lot of bona fides there on that front. I found the number, by the way. 75% of OpenAI's revenue last year was thought to be consumer. That's an extrapolated stat, not a hard one from the company. But even if it's directionally accurate, I think it's fair to say that the company is still a majority consumer business, which I think makes the revenue seem a little bit less solid, given what you're saying about the potential for disruption there. But at least for now, it's working.
I could see, you know, like I was thinking the other day, like how many of these things am I actually paying for? Maybe I need to cut a couple. Like if I'm paying $30 a month for five of them, I think I'm paying probably $1,800 a year. Sure, a business person is not a lot if you're, and for somebody who covers it as an investor, it's not a lot. But even I was thinking like, yeah, maybe I'll cut the bottom two. Do I need to have that? Or maybe I'll get a backup account that I share with the entire team on one common email address, you know, so we can sample it once in a while. What's going on with the venture funds slowing their pace? Because I think this is also kind of an interesting trend if we're going to get into it. And I think Wednesday we're going to have our first VC roundtable on the show. Is that right?
We are. I'm starting to work on that actually right after the show. We're going to get the outline pulled together. So everyone expect a fun episode on Wednesday. Okay. So venture fund investing pace. Here we are talking about a chart shared by Megan Reynolds. Regular viewers of the show, Jason, will recall that she came to the 2024 Liquidity Summit. We shared her talk in episode 2008. If you want to go hear how she discusses the LP side of relationships in the venture game, and that's because she leads both talent and capital formation over at Altimeter. All right, all that said, she shared a very interesting chart showing the time between funds. And I'm going to pull up this chart here, Jason, and just give everyone a quick overview if they're on the audio. It's a time series chart tracking data from 2005 to 2024. And it shows how many months between funds from the same firm. And it gives a middle 50% interval and then also a median number. And it breaks this data into three categories: the kind of like olden days from 2005 to 2013, then the acceleration through COVID, which was 2014 through 2022, and then the last couple of years. And just to kick you off here, Jason, I ran all these numbers into a sheet, and the average for the first era was a 45-month gap between funds. Then that fell to a 29-month gap in the accelerated COVID-era ZIRP period. And then most recently, it's come back up to 31.5. I'm curious what you see in this data.
It's fascinating. I think people used to raise a fund and they were methodical deploying it over 3 or 4 years, from 2005 all the way to... the chart just went off the screen.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Don't worry about it. I have the chart on my notes here. So just looking at it in my notes here, if you look at, or maybe leave it up so the audience can see as I sort of sportscast it. But if you look from 2005 all the way to 2014, that goes through the great financial crisis, right? Right up until things started to boom. And you have the average. I'm looking at the average dots, which are in the middle. And it starts in 2005 with 49 months to deploy a fund, right? That's after the dot-com bust. And then we see 52, 36, 42, 41, 46, 47, 45, 48. And then all of a sudden drop to 36 months to deploy a fund in 2014. So that's an interesting 10-year cycle there of where people were taking, you know, 40 some odd months, 3.5, 4 years. I've always thought 3 years of primary investing was the right timing between funds, maybe four. Then we get into sort of ZIRP, it's getting really hot in here, kind of era. And oh my Lord, You know, here at This Week in Startups, we try to keep founders just up to speed on all these trends in AI and marketing, but we can't do it alone. But you're also going to need to connect in person with your colleagues and partners and innovators. There's no substitute for in-person. So if you want to connect with visionary leaders and personalities like Dario Amodi, Victor Riperbelli, Dharmesh Shah, my friend, and more, your chance is to do that at Inbound 2025. That's right, the epicenter of tech innovation that will help you transform your strategy as we approach the AI era is happening this year from September 3rd to 5th in my old hometown of San Francisco, California. It's a rare chance to really immerse yourself in San Francisco's unique venture ecosystem where new companies can quickly evolve into billion-dollar unicorns and beyond. Use the code TWIST10 at checkout to get 10% off your GA ticket at inbound.com/register. Inbound.com/register. That's inbound.com/register. In 2022, there was a 20-month, and in, 20, if you look at 2020, 2021, 2022, that kind of tells the story. 23, 24, and 20 months between raising funds, you know, numbered sequential funds. That's wild. That's wild. That means in you were going back to your LPs every, you know, 2.5, 3 years. It's just crazy. And now we're back up to 34, it looks like. So reversion to the meme. But yeah, ZIRP was not thoughtful. And then what happens is there's a very practical thing that happens here, Alex. If you concentrate all your bets in a 2-year period versus a 3 or even better 4-year period, if you take 4 years, then if there was a boom or a bust that happened, you might have 2 years of boom, like peak ZIRP, and then 2 years in the trough. You know, or you might have just rid the last 4 years of the boom up, but at least the first 2 years might not be what would have been as unreasonable, right? Or you could have gotten lucky. All 4 years are deployed at the bottom of the market, like we are, I think, over the last year or two. And then boom, it all comes back and you're a hero. Or the 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 vintages that were just Airbnbs, Coinbases, Ubers, et cetera. Lots of juicy stuff in there.
The compressed timeframe then just really makes your venture funds bets incredibly concentrated on a time basis, which is worrying to me. But I want to go back to the 2014 point. We saw a pretty rapid shift from a 48-month median deployment time to 36. Yeah. That's a 25% decline in 1 year. And honestly, 2014 kind of to me is the start of the unicorn era. Companies staying private longer, raising more money. And so I wonder if some of the decline in time between funds was simply the ability of firms to write larger checks that were growing faster than their proximate funds were. So let's say you can write a $100 billion check instead of 50, that's 2x. But if your funding goes up by 30%, you know, incrementally from one, fund two, fund three, you could end up burning through your fund faster. And that can work well if it's all going into Coinbase, or it can go pretty poorly if it's all going into WeWork. So I'm curious to see what the new normal will be. I don't think we're going back to 52 months like we saw in 2006, though. So for founders, though, Jason, we are seeing funds take a little bit longer to invest. Yep. I'm curious, what does this mean for on-the-ground folks? If you're out there raising a pre-seed, seed, or Series A, how should this change or just impact your thinking about how you approach the capital markets?
You know, a lot of times founders, I find, get too obsessive with the market conditions and what's going on in VC land. And they tend to start blaming the VCs as opposed to looking at what they're doing. And that is reasonable. If you're not having people throw money at you, you're probably like, well, the VCs just don't understand. It's like somebody who writes a great screenplay and is a director and you're Quentin Tarantino and nobody will make your movie. And then you're like, you know what? I'm going to put Pulp Fiction and True Romance aside. I'm going to work on this little more narrow thing, Reservoir Dogs, and I'll prove it. You got to do your Reservoir Dog. It's up to you as a founder to get that prototype built in today's market, in the vibe coding 25, in the roaring vibe coding 20s. You kind of got to get your product to market. You kind of got to get to 5K a month in revenue. You kind of got to get to 10 customers giving you $500 a month or 100 giving you 100, whatever it is, and have two or three people, you know, grinding on it. Based on sweat equity, there's very few J-Cal Y's and Y Combinators out there taking flyers on teams. I'll just be totally honest about it. Everybody's waiting to see who hits $1 million, $2 million, or $3 million in revenue. Nobody wants to do the hard work of, you know, I think our firm is writing 60 25K checks this year and maybe 30 125K checks. And we'll do 10, you know, 250K C checks, something in that range. And so you start doing the math on that. Like, most people don't want to bother running an accelerator or a pre-accelerator that gives you your first friends and family check because it's hard. Really hard.
Other than that,
it creates a lot of work.
Yeah.
Well, if you have a pool of capital, what's a better life if you're trying to do lifestyle? And maybe you just ask your friends, what are you investing in? And can I put 250, 500K into what you're investing in? And so for founders, just know where you're at. If you got the first 500K check from a seed fund, the other two 250K checks are going to quickly follow because you got that person as an anchor and they've got conviction and you've got, in that case, 250K in revenue, 500K in revenue, and they're just going to, you know, zip, zip, zip. If you're before that and you're trying to pitch the same group of people, you're probably not going to get them unless you're a second-time entrepreneur. So then you have to get the customer. So focus relentlessly on customer, product market fit. It'll all work out. And if it doesn't work out on this startup and you run out of cash and you don't get product market fit, well, then you're going to be better the second time around.
Yes.
And you'll be able to get product market fit faster with less resources. And that's the key. Can you get product market fit? How fast and for how little money and overhead can you get to product market fit?
Okay, we're doing this a little out of the order I had in mind, but I that's too good of a corollary to bring up the data from Andreessen. We just can't pass it up. So Andreessen Horowitz dropped some data looking at companies both in their portfolio and companies that they had seen and gotten enough information from to include inside of their kind of bucket of data, if you will. This is all anonymized, but we're talking about the path to Series A, Jason, and we're trying to figure out the revenue benchmarks for high quality, if you will, for both enterprise and consumer AI startups. Now, this is under the umbrella of our startup growing faster today than ever before. And I think also to your point about why a lot of investors want to see some traction, because companies are growing so quickly, why not wait for some? So here's a bit of data from Andreessen about revenue benchmarks for enterprise Gen AI startups. And just sportscasting for folks out there, this shows three different quartiles, the bottom, the median, and then the top. And it shows revenue growth at 6 months after monetization and 12 months. So if you're a median enterprise Gen AI startup, after 6 months, Jason, of selling your product, you have about $700,000 worth of ARR. And at month 12, 2.1. At the top quartile, it's 2 million ARR at 6 months and 5.3 million at the 12-month point. And if you are in that top quartile, you raise your Series A just 7 months after your seed round.
Okay, so let's pause there before we get to the amount they raised afterwards. So getting to 500, 700, or 2 million in revenue in just 6 months is absolutely fantastic. So anybody who does that is a winner. So this data is a subset already. These are people who got to revenue. Remember, probably 80% of startups never get to revenue. And I would say 90% of startups never get to 500K in revenue. So this is like literally the top 10% or 5% of startups, you know, coming out of Y Combinator, Launch Accelerator, Techstars, et cetera, Antler. So the bottom quartile here is in fact like the 90th percentile in startup land. So just so we don't neg them.
Sorry. Yes. Good point, Jason.
Yeah. Cause this is, and as you can see, the bottom group goes two and a half times in from 6 to 12 months. So they're growing at a nice pace. The 0.7 triples to 2.1 and the 2 million, you know, 2.5 to 5.3. In other words, they grow their revenue pretty briskly between that 6 and 12 month period, which is indicative of product market fit that we just talked about. The first 6 months, you get product market fit, but it's light, it's loose. And then something happens between months 6 and 12 That's not month 6 or 12 of the startup. That's month 6 after launching. So let's assume they spent a year in the lab with unpaid trials, going through an incubator. So this would be month 18 and month 24 is probably from the incorporation date or when they started writing code and doing customer research is probably what we're looking at here. It might even be like 18 months in the lab with free customers, et cetera. So it might even be 24 and 30 months, something in that range is what we're talking about here. But these things are growing quickly and Andreessen has made a bucket of people who are in the top 10%. What's very interesting here is the time to Series A.
Mm-hmm.
I think you would agree, is that if you're a fast-growing startup, that top quartile raises their Series A in 7 months after launching revenue. So if that 7 months and they launched in month 18 or 12, you know, they're getting that Series A, you know, by end of year two, very impressive. And then 13 months from the bottom and 9 from the top. It's very interesting. Yeah.
The thing that really struck me though, Jason, if you look at this chart, and I'll take it down in a second, but it shows how much money they raised these companies before mm-hmm. their Series A. And there's an inverse correlation between pace of growth and time to Series A and capital raised. So the companies that grew the fastest and raised the most quickly, reaching that Series A milestone, raised in this data set, 2.3 million, 4 million for the median and 5.5 million for the bottom quartile. So essentially the companies that are raising the least are growing the fastest, which surprised me because frankly, there's
money is useful.
Okay, yeah, tell me why.
Doesn't surprise me. Having less resources makes you scrappier and they needed less resources. So they spent less time raising money because they were making more from customers. So that's the best part of the data. That last column is the best part of the data. Everything, you know, is like as expected for me. The last row is super confirming of a trend that I was monitoring and talking about for the past year or two, which is the breakout companies now that really figure out revenue are raising much less and they don't need to raise as much. And this confirms that. Now, I don't know if this is based on 10 companies or 100. It would be really nice to know the denominator here and how they got to.
I think they're trying to be a little bit
aloof
from the data so they can share it.
So important data here for entrepreneurs to consider. The most important things here are that if you get product market fit early, you're going to be in great shape. Because if you get product market fit early, then you need to raise less capital and you own more of the cap table and you spend less time fundraising. The people who don't have product market fit have to convince people, create arguments, as opposed to just showing their data and saying, talk to my top three customers. If your top three customers are over the moon, it's all going to work out. Before we go to the customer, let's just do the YC thing real quick.
Yes, let's do that.
Because that's the kind of button on all of this.
Yes, we actually had a really great kind of coordinated link of data points today. All right. So Nicole Wiskoff from Wiskoff Ventures posted some very interesting data over on the Twitters and Gary Tan did respond. So we have quite a lot to discuss here, Jason, but here is the data she put out. Mm. She grabbed some data from the Y Combinator Spring 2025 batch. And then she looked at a number of non-YC pre-agency companies from around the same era. And she found that from the YC cohort, the average round size, 3 million, average cap on their safe notes was about 25 million, and their average ARR just over 100K. For non-YC pre-seed and seed companies at around the same time, average round size, 2.4 million, smaller, average valuation cap on their safe, 15 million, much lower, and their average ARR was 290,000, much more. There's a lot of nuance to this data, Jason, but did any of that surprise you when you saw it?
No, not at all. What Y Combinator has done is what Harvard has done. They've created an incredible brand that people are willing to pay for value or perceived value. You can make a big debate there. Mm-hmm. This data, of course, is probably trends. It follows the absolute trend I see, which is non-YC companies with traction versus YC companies with traction. You're going to get essentially here half the price for triple the performance, which is 6x leverage, but let's just call it 5x leverage on every dollar invested. This mm-hmm. is why a lot of folks have opted out of the YC game because there are a lot of dentists and a lot of folks coming to Y Combinator Demo Day who are, you know, maybe not as entry price discerning. And the majority of unicorns in Silicon Valley did not go to Y Combinator. They didn't get backed by Sequoia and they didn't get backed by me. That's just the nature of how big our market is. Mm-hmm. So going to, and I would say a percentage of Y Combinator companies I know historically don't clear market. So they try for $25 million on the valuation cap, but Nicole might never meet them because they give up trying to raise money or they raise a small amount at a smaller valuation and, you know, they don't make their way to the seed funds. In other words, this data is kind of skimming the cream of two different groups, I think. So let's put in there. Yeah.
Just like the Andreessen data we were just discussing, correct. We're talking about companies that Andreessen cared about or invested in. So we're already looking at a pretty top rarefied 10%. Circle.
Yeah. So I think, and if Y Combinator accepts 1% of startups and companies that get to 25K a month in revenue, I would say, you know, in the non-YC pre-seed and seed cos, that would equal 1% of startups that were formed, you know, in the United States. So this data is about the 1% of startups in the seed ecosystem. And it is correct. You will pay 5x net-net on the valuation to the ARR performance. Now, but, you know, listen, there's Airbnb who went to Y Combinator. So people are hoping of the 500 companies, or I'm not sure how many they're doing a year now. Maybe
their cohorts have gotten smaller again.
So, okay. Yeah. So there's three cohorts now instead of two, I think. And I think they're doing 250 per or 200 per. So if they're doing 250 per and they're doing three, that's 750. So it was at 500. It would be good to know mm-hmm. that number because for Y Combinator or Techstars or us, we're doing a large amount of bets, knowing that our pull-through rate is going to be 50%, 60%, 70%. I bet, you know, of YC companies, maybe 60%, 70% actually wind up raising a round. That mm-hmm. statistic is the one you really need to look at. What this means is if you get accepted to Y Combinator, go. If you get accepted to Launch, go. If you get accepted to Founder University, go. Mm-hmm. Antler, Techstars, I don't know the other top accelerators out there. I suppose it's probably a steep drop off from there. But if you can get into one of these programs, they act as a filtering mechanism for people like Nicole. People like Nicole do not have a big enough staff to sort through the 20,000 applications we get, the 50,000 that Y Combinator gets, the 40,000 that Techstar gets, Antler probably gets 40,000 or 30,000. It's just too much work to get through all those. So what you're looking for as a seed manager or a pre-seed fund is for somebody to just weed out people who can't show up for 12 weeks in a row to an accelerator and have three co-founders, one of which is a developer submitting code who owns over 10% of the equity on the cap table. That's what we do at our accelerator or at Founder University or YC or Techstars. That's what we all do. We curate a group of apples, you know, picked from the same orchard that aren't bruised, that are shiny and new. Mm-hmm. And don't have worms in them, and we put them out, you know, and say, hey, look, we worked with these apples. These are some good apples. How about these apples? But if you were a venture capitalist, the best thing to do is to go to demo day, collect all the information, do all the meetings, and then wait 1 year to then go and meet with your favorite companies. Because I guarantee you, if you're raising at $25 million valuation caps, if this data is directionally correct, and I believe it to be, mm-hmm. with 100 in ARR, it's 250 times revenue, yeah. right? So if you wait 1 year, that company will have spent that $3 million or much of it. They'll have gotten to 300K in revenue. And if they do a $25 million round, now they're still at 100 times or 90 times revenue, which is still extraordinary. And you can make the same bet with three or four times the revenue. So stay in touch with the company, et cetera. I would, and these companies will get funded. So just pause and then do the funding after is my best bet. That's the best advice.
I agree with that from the venture perspective. I do want to say that Gary Tan, I want to give him his
oh, yeah.
words
his
here.
Response.
He had a couple different notes, but one he said is that the vast majority of YC startups start with just an idea or with no revenue, meaning that they are younger at demo day age than other startups raising similar rounds. So he thinks that the ARR comparisons that Nicole put up are a little bit specious, but we're always talking about in private markets, incomplete data. And so we're always doing our best. I don't think she's being at all malicious. I think Gary has a reasonable point, but no matter how you slice it, you're still paying quite a lot for not a lot of revenue. And Jason, if you want to hear more from Nicole Wiskoff, episode 2061 from last December, we had her on the show. She's a great interview.
I would say his response about don't worry about YC 7% equity take is a good comment. I tell people this about our accelerator or YC. Now, if it was 10% or 15%, I would be a little bit worried because that's a large number. But any of these programs, that 7% gets made up for in the valuation you get if you go raise money after, whether it's our program or his program or any program. Yeah. And the AR comparison, the vast majority of YC startups are just an idea with no revenue. Just an idea with no revenue. $25 million is a pretty crazy valuation to ask for just an idea with no revenue. So I think that doesn't make a lot of sense. These results on the best in class for the companies, that's TVPI. So I would ignore this because that's paper gains, not DPI.
I'm pulling this up for you right now, Jason. Yeah. I just had to make it big.
Yeah.
So here we go.
Who made this chart, but maybe it's Carta. It's Carta data, maybe. Yeah, this is not a good chart to go on because this is just paper gains. And we just established that YC gets you a higher valuation that is outside, to Gary's own admission. Like, don't worry about the 7% because we're going to get you a higher valuation. Then that means the valuations are inflated because of the Y Combinator reputation, and justly so, because they have a great reputation and they run a great program. What that means is the paper gains are not what you should be looking at when making a decision and evaluating them. You should be looking at the DPI and the distributions that actually got generated. Paper gains are inflated here by Gary Tan's own admission. He's saying, come to YC because we're going to get you a much higher valuation, five times more than a non-YC startup. If that actually is true, then these numbers based on TVPI would need to be divided by five or divided by three or something. And then you would be looking at much different numbers. And actually, I think if you did that, the top 10% being 3X, that might actually be the actual correct number. 3X is great for a fund. Okay.
3X is great for a fund. All right. Now, Jason, I do want to get to our office hours today. We're getting back into this now that you're no longer over in Singapore. Hmm. And so today we have Sean Stigerwald from Customer IQ. They were in Founder University Cohort 8. They are in Launch Accelerator Cohort 34. Please welcome Sean to the show. Sean, hey. Oh my gosh.
Hey.
You've got too much hair, just for starters. How dare you, sir?
You look great. All right. So tell everybody what Customer IQ does and how it's going.
Yeah, definitely. So we work with revenue teams to expand their capacity by automating email and CRM data entry. And it's going well. Most people hate both of those things, so they love when we solve them.
Who would be the ideal customer for your startup? The ICP, as we say in the business, ideal customer profile.
Yeah, ideally it's teams with large sales teams, and they send a lot of quotes. So they have a ton of just action going on in their inbox. It's really important for them to get them out quickly, respond to people quickly, and then follow up. And those are three things that our agent helps a ton with.
Are people, if I'm explaining the product correctly, are people cool with automated communications with customers, or do they like to have the AI kind of queue up the communications and tell you, like, hey, this might be a good thing to send to that customer you signed 6 months ago and haven't spoken to since?
Yeah, great question. So we never send without the user reviewing. It's all drafts. So what they love is that it's in the inbox, and that's one of the unique things that we do. So we integrate directly with Gmail and Outlook. And for example, like, my favorite part, every morning you get an email from Quinn, is the name of the agent, and says, hey, you sent 14 emails over the last few days where we expected a response and we didn't get one. So I left these drafts in the drafts folder, and they just flip over to the drafts and they go through and they review them. And as they send them out, it gets better, but it's never sending, as they make edits, it gets better, but it's never sending on their behalf.
So I pay for Superhuman. Superhuman is doing drafts for me. Why would I use Customer IQ if Superhuman's doing that already? What's the difference between the two products? Now, I know the answer to this, but I'm giving you a softball.
Just teeing it up. Yeah, sure. Superhuman, phenomenal if you're an email power user. And it's just like such a thoughtful interface over the email. We build an agent that lives in the inbox. So all of our users, they're either committed to or just still using like Gmail or Outlook, the actual interface. Nothing about that changes. They keep using it the same way. And then we're focused on revenue teams, which is sales and customer success. What we build might not end up making as much sense to maybe support or product management or some of these other roles in the companies that we work with.
Got it.
And you kind of see that reflected in a bunch of different features that we ship.
You also have access to some unique data when you're drafting your emails, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. So the two-pronged approach of integrating with the CRM and automating all that data in there means we have just amazing context of what should be written here, like what good looks like, data that performs well in deals, and that kind of keeps expanding. And as the models get better, the context is the most important thing. So we help them automate a bunch of the busy work and what data gets put into that system. But in the actionable bits that the agent does in drafting, we can use that to do it even better.
So if I have somebody in my Salesforce or my HubSpot, you're using that as part of the drafts, yeah?
Yeah, just imagine like in Salesforce or HubSpot, a contact or an account record. Ultimately, those are like profiles of people that you're speaking to. And when you go to write emails or reach out or follow up or you work some sales process, that profile really informs everything. And the models have this incredible intelligence and ability to write just like you and solve that blank page problem. But those profiles give it all the context. And so, yeah, that's what we use.
Sean, I want to ask about the contextual AI engine that kind of underpins Quinn. Is this a model you guys trained yourself? Is it a model you've built on top of? Curious about that. And then also just data privacy, because if you're inside of my email, you're inside of the absolute most critical information in my business. So how do you guys handle bringing in context to do this work without sacrificing some privacy for the user?
Yeah, the context is all is really everything. And that engine we describe is really like a really intricate RAG format, or just the system that we've created. It's a retrieval augmented generation. Yeah. It's when we know we have a task to do and we need the LLM to go do it, what information can we pull in from those CRM profiles or past conversations, like little nuggets that have been saved along the way to make that really, really good. And so that's that contextual bit that we talk about. And it's what differentiates Customer IQ from just out of the box using Gemini, for example, like in Gmail. If you ask it to write an email, most people have experienced this. It definitely writes an email for you, but it's not usually in your tone and style. It has no knowledge of like this process or this deal.
You guys host the AI models internally on kind of on your own metal, or are these the models that you're accessing via commercial APIs?
Right now it's commercial APIs. As we're early stage. As we start bringing on more and more larger customers, I definitely see a world where we are hosting open source models using that, and especially as those get better, the magic is really in the context. Then that can be, to answer your security question, like that's the same software practices we've always used in software development. Yeah, we use AWS as our main backend, follow all encrypted data best practices. Go through SOC 2 compliance audits, all of that.
Right. Yeah.
All right. Right. So you went through Found University. You're in the accelerator now, or you're in the next flush. You're in the accelerator now.
Yeah, we're in right now. Yeah.
So that's great. We just had a whole conversation about, year one startups and getting revenue. You've got customers, you've got revenue. That's amazing. You have questions for me. What's challenging? Any blockers, any frustrations, anything you need advice on?
Yeah, definitely. There's a couple things. One interesting, maybe even conversation to be had is this is my third company, third software company. First time ever in obviously in AI, as most of what's usable today is
pretty new.
Pretty new. And one like investor question we get, and also just thing we think about every day, is usage and like think about monthly active users. It's kind of a whole different world now where the vast majority of our users don't actually log in to Customer IQ. They sign up, they get set up initially, but then Quinn lives in their inbox and they kind of work alongside it every day. So I don't know if you have any advice around just managing that or thinking about it?
So there's there is a big question now. If companies are going to have less employees, then selling a per seat basis that requires them to have less employees means you're empowering them to spend less money with you.
Right.
So let's let that sink in.
Yeah.
If you do your job, then 10 salespeople could come down to 6 because they're selling, or 5 because you're selling twice as much because your product's so damn good. So you probably want to get some sort of a consumption or the amount of sales and how you improve it metric. Hard to do. I might be selling ads on a podcast and my book of business might be low millions of dollars. Alex might be selling, you know, HVAC solutions for, you know, campuses, and the average sales might be a $10 million contract per year, and it's a 3-year contract for $30 million. So how do you reconcile that, right? It's two different groups, same type of person, but different ticket sizes, et cetera. So, you know, you have to find something that is going to, like Salesforce, there's a third of people who will never use Salesforce because what is Salesforce course now? Like $3,000 a person per year?
I know there's a $500 a month per seat plan. So yeah, it's up there. Yeah.
Well, that's $6,000 a year per salesperson. Right. That's why we don't use it. And so like, doesn't make any sense. And it's also cumbersome and whatever. So you'll find who your ideal customer profile is, who wants to embrace this. You come up with a price maybe for their activity and the number of users, the number of records in their CRM, maybe the number of active engaged customers. So the more they engage customers and the more the customers respond, the more you get paid. So if you are in fact helping somebody engage in more customers, maybe it's $500 a month plus, $10 for every record in the CRM or every customer engaged. Or, you know, charging less than the value you provide is like one of the things startups do really well. So if Salesforce is $6,000, maybe we're charging, you know, $1,000 a year or $2,000 a year, and maybe making it not necessary for them to have Salesforce. So I would get audacious here and think, if this is how the future of sales is, this really thoughtful, you know, agent working with you, maybe the agent is, you know, $50,000 a year. And either you want that agent in your 10 salespeople's email box or you don't. And you just go for the people who are selling those $30 million contracts, $10 million contracts, 7-figure deals only, or 6 or 7-figure deals only. And anybody who's not selling 6 or 7-figure deals, like, you should not use this product. And you just go straight for the high end and you help customize it for them and you give them a lot of attention. Or the other approach is you do what HubSpot did, which is it's very affordable. It's almost too affordable. It makes no sense how cheap HubSpot is. So congratulations on the success. If people want to get in touch with you, what's your email in case investors, angels, seed funds, employee, potential team members, or most importantly, customers want to get a direct line to the CEO? What's his email?
That's Sean@getcustomeriq.com. So the get part important, but Sean,
get
S-E-A-M.
Customer.
Yep.
Sean, I guess getcustomeriq.com. Okay. Continued success, and really, sky's the limit. I'm so excited that you went to Founder University and the accelerator. I think it's like becoming a big pattern that we see people, Alex, over 12 weeks in the Founder University, and we see people who are taking it seriously. And watching people work, this is like a great lesson for me in my life, is when you watch people work, kind of hard to fake it. You can, kind of hard. So if you can like make a great steak and I watch you make it, and then I take a bite, you know, like that, it's kind of hard to fake. I mean, you could have gotten lucky and made the perfect steak, but I doubt it. Okay, we'll see you all next time on, you know what? Alex, everybody had a question for me. Where's the all-in episode? We'll see you all next time on This Week in Startups. Bye-bye.